It's okay. You can bring your beer on up. Have a seat. Get another one. So it's nice to see all these, the amount of people that have showed up tonight. It's really great. We're really excited about the speaker that we have here tonight. We heard him this morning, and it really has a lot of information that's applicable to what's going on in the Mat-Su Borough. My name is Jeff Davis. I'm with the Science and Data Committee for the Mat-Su Salmon Habitat Partnership. How many people here are members of the partnership? Anybody? So the rest of you, it's really the Mat-Su Basin Salmon Habitat Partnership is really a group of organizations and people that have got together, and they've developed a strategic action plan that has identified the threats to salmon within the Mat-Su Borough, and Matanuska and Susitna River drainages, and then different priority actions that can be taken to protect salmon, to protect salmon habitats. So it's all a lot of volunteers that come together and work on different projects, and they have a lot of support through different agencies. National Marine Fisheries Service, certainly Fish and Wildlife Service, has done a lot to support the partnership, Fish and Game, other agencies at both the state and federal level. So we're really trying to do a lot to identify threats to salmon and to protect salmon and their habitats. Every year, the Mat-Su Basin Salmon Habitat Partnership has the Science Symposium, which has gone on all day today and will be also going on tomorrow, that you can join if you didn't show up today. So a lot of talks on a lot of the work that the partnership has been funding and that has been doing over the last year. Speaker that we have tonight is Dr. John Schindler from the University of Washington. He's done a lot of work in Alaska. He's been 20 years working on Western Alaska and on salmon issues, a number of peer-reviewed publications and awards for his work. He's going to be talking about resiliency and diversity over the landscape and how that affects biotic communities and how that affects salmon. And as he's talking, I think we should keep in mind the diversity of habitats we have here in the Susitna River drainage, from large glacial rivers, semi-glacial streams like the Keshwitna and Sheep Creek, brown water systems, lake and stream systems, a huge diversity of habitats in the Susitna drainage and the Matanuska drainage that really provides the template for the diverse salmon species that we have in the different populations. And as Dr. Schindler will describe, how that makes them resilient to any kind of perturbations. So thanks again for coming, and here's Dr. Schindler.
Thank you for the introduction, and thanks for showing up tonight. For those of you who were here this morning, you could probably leave right now. It's the same talk. The public can understand the science just as well as the scientists can, I think. Anyhow, I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you about some of the things we've learned about salmon stocks in Western Alaska, particularly in Bristol Bay, where I've done most of my research. And the topic that the organizers asked me to discuss tonight is this idea of resilience and how salmon stocks and watersheds make them resilient. And when I use the word resilient here, really what I'm talking about is how the system of interest is producing, in this case, fish. And a system that's resilient is one that can be disturbed from some outside influence, but then maintain the services and the functions that we depend on. So in the case of salmon in Bristol Bay, Alaska, the service of interest is producing fish that are caught in commercial sport and subsistence fisheries, but also fish serve important ecological services and the watersheds that they return to spawn in. So the question is, what makes these systems robust or resilient to changes in the environment? And the changes of interest here are really climate change and changes in fishing pressure. So here we are in Western Alaska. Bristol Bay is a unique region for lots of reasons. It was heavily glaciated during the last glaciation, and when the glaciers receded, what it left behind is an overburden of lots of gravel and a very wide diversity of different types of aquatic habitats, dominated by a series of very large lakes and then a series of short rivers that drain them. And what I'm going to talk about today is really the collective experience of the University of Washington, who's been working on these systems since the 1940s. This was before Alaska was a state. The canneries that were mostly based in the Pacific Northwest had moved up here in the late 1800s, 1890s or so, and they started hammering these salmon runs. And in the 30s, they started recognizing, the 1930s, they started recognizing that the salmon returns were substantially declining. And they were concerned that they were over-harvesting these salmon populations. Because there was no state, the salmon were actually managed out of Washington, D.C., basically with no scientific understanding at all. Basically, the rule of thumb was take half the fish that return in any given year, let the other half escape to the spawning grounds. And the canneries weren't willing to accept this as being a logical way to manage these systems. So they approached the University of Washington about establishing a research program to develop scientific-based understanding of the systems that could be then used for managing. So that was 1945-46, and we've managed to keep some long-term records of these salmon populations and of their ecosystems since then. And by total, well, it's not serendipitous, but we're in the lucky position that during this time period, Alaska has warmed as fast as any other part of the Earth, and we have records that span this period of warming. I know global climate change is a somewhat controversial subject among some groups, but we have lots of data to show that it is a reality here in Alaska, and I'm sure lots of people here have experienced it as well. Here's one example. This is the day of ice breakup on one of the study lakes. This is Lake Alegnagik. Records starting in 1950 through to last year. The orange line here is the long-term average, which is about May 28th or so. And you can see that historically, back in the 60s and 70s, often the ice broke up, you know, 1 to 2 weeks after that. And since then, it's been slowly, gradually getting earlier. There's still the occasional late year, but on average, the ice is breaking up about a week earlier than normal. If you remember, last winter was a fairly warm year, and it was a warm spring, and I haven't plotted last year's data point on here yet, but there it is. It was 2 weeks earlier than the previous record. So when you hear in the news that 2016 was a warm year globally, it really was a warm year in Alaska. So what we do know from this is that over this period of time that we've had this distinct warming trend, there's actually been an increase in the productivity of salmon populations throughout most of Western Alaska, particularly in Bristol Bay. There are more salmon caught there now in the last 20 years than there were at any other time in the history of the fisheries there. So I'm going to return to this question about what makes Bristol Bay fisheries so resilient. You know, what about the system allows a pretty repeatable number of fish to return every year, despite the fact that the climate has changed distinctly? And the way to understand this, or what's important to understand this, is the hierarchy over which habitat is structured that the fish interact with. So the fish spend about half their lives in the ocean, where there's some mixing out here, and then they return to 9 major rivers in Bristol Bay. And of course, I think most Alaskans know that salmon return to their river where they were born based on smell and various other ways of navigating. So each of these rivers is genetically distinct. And then within each river, those stocks separate out into individual populations that spawn in smaller rivers or in beaches of lakes or in tiny little streams. So in something like the Wood River system, where I spend most of my field research, There are dozens of individual distinct populations of sockeye salmon that are genetically distinct from one another, and this genetic distinctiveness is a reflection of the habitat that they are occupying. Okay, so let's look at what has made the system resilient over the last century. So here's data from Fish and Game starting from 1960 to the present, and this is just the total number of fish that have returned to Bristol Bay rivers. Of course, these are the ones that are harvested for subsistence, and then what was the early fishing, commercial fishing fleet, and then the modern fishing fleet. And what you can see is over this time period, there is some year-to-year variation in returns, but it's been holding pretty constant at around 35 to 45 million fish a year, particularly in the last 40 years or so. The important point that I want you to take away from this figure, though, is the change in the colors. So each color is the number of fish that were caught or escaped to the river to each of the individual rivers. And what you can see is in the 60s and early 70s, all of Bristol Bay was really dominated by a single stock of salmon. These were fish returning to the Quijack River that drains Iliamna Lake. And at this point in time, both the managers and the fishing fleet believed that all of the action in Bristol Bay was in this single river. All these other rivers that contributed just a little tiny amount were really sideshows that most people didn't think of as particularly important. But because there was no or very little development pressure in Bristol Bay, these rivers were conserved, you know, indirectly because they weren't developed for any industrial purpose. Well, then climate started shifting, and now what we see is that the Quijack in yellow is actually a relatively small player in the system. But the system hasn't collapsed, it is just reorganized. Now we have just as many fish coming back, but they're coming back from different rivers. So things like the Nooshagak and the Igigik system, many of these other rivers, ramped up their production under different climate regimes. So in terms of resilience, what happened here is the system is still producing fish, but how it produces those fish has changed. The landscape is continuously changing. The number of fish that individual rivers produce has changed over this time. So this is sort of a hallmark of what we think of as resilience, the ability to reorganize while maintaining your function. Another way to think about this is what this means for the reliability of fisheries. So I'm guessing some of you are fishers, and if this is how you make your living or if this is how you recreate, the reliability of going back every year and being able to catch something actually means something to you. Well, this is what the populations look like if we look at an individual river. So what I've done here is just plotting up data from a single river that's been normalized so that one is the long-term average. This is 10% of the long-term average, and that's 10 times the long-term average. This is a logarithmic scale, so it's a little bit weird. But what you see is that this single river can bounce between about 3% of the long-term average in any given year to maybe five times the long-term average in any given year. So if you're a fisher who is trying to make a living off of this resource, it's going to be a tough go because, first of all, it's not very predictable. Some years you're going to get 10% of your normal paycheck, and some years you're going to get five times your normal paycheck. It's hard to imagine how that could be a sustainable resource in terms of supporting communities and supporting livelihoods. The reason it's sustainable is appreciated, I think, if you overlay all the other rivers in the region. So now each other river is overlaid here. If you squint your eyes, you can see some degree of coherence in terms of the ups and downs. But the reason it's sustainable is because all the rivers don't necessarily boom and bust in the same year. So what I've overlaid here is the average in dark. And what you can see is that the commercial fishery in this case has a much more reliable return of fish because there's diversity in the system. If the Quijack is down on one year, by chance, another river like the Naknek or Igigik system may be up. And when they are down, the Quijack may be up. So they compensate for one another because they have a range of responses to the same change in the overriding environment. And the metaphor we use here is of a portfolio like you might invest in if you're thinking about your retirement. So if you had a plug of money to invest in your retirement fund, you could either go in and buy the hottest stock of the day and hope that it plays out. But if you think about it a little bit, you realize that's a really bad strategy. What you need to do is diversify your investments across a bunch of different stocks because that's a way to ensure or reduce risk in the system. In the case of Bristol Bay Fisheries, they've benefited from such a diversified approach simply because the rivers have their own dynamics. They show different responses to the same environmental change. And as a result, they're reliable or otherwise called resilient. So when we add up, what are fisheries worth in Alaska or in Bristol Bay, the common thing to do is just add up the number of dollars that were brought in and divide by the number of years, and that's the amount of average earnings by the fishery in every given year. And that turns out to be a big number for Bristol Bay Fisheries, but it also, I think, is important to realize that the reliability and the returns is possibly just as important. Whether you're a subsistence fisher or a commercial fisher or a sport fisher, this reliability actually has social value to it. If things are totally unpredictable, it's hard to imagine how you would have a quote-unquote fishing community stick around through time. You need reliable flows. I mean, tax returns in a lot of Alaska are derived from fishing revenues. So if fishing revenues are all over the map, tax revenues are going to be all over the map. You can imagine how that's not going to be a very reliable base for communities. In the case of Bristol Bay Fisheries, they have been relatively stable. You still maintain fishing communities because of the complexity of the river systems that produce the fish that are exploited. Some people who have seen, this part of the talk will say, well, what you're looking at is really some aberration of nature because it's been so heavily fished for so long. It's been fished for a century now. Some years, there's not 80% of the fish are harvested before they return. The long-term average is around 50 or 60%. So these fish have been harvested heavily. They've been harvested for thousands of years, of course, by people who live in here, but the commercial fisheries really ramped it up in the 1890s. So some suggest that maybe this degree of complexity and the stabilizing effects are some aberration of the last 100 years. So we did some work where we could actually look at the prehistorical records that are captured in the ecosystems to answer this question about how variable salmon returns were and how synchronous they were among rivers, say 400, 500 years ago. And it sounds a bit like magic, and it is a bit of magic, but of course these fish are spending half their time in the ocean, half their lives in the ocean. That's where they put on almost all their growth. So they're accumulating nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus and carbon in the ocean. They come back to fresh waters to spawn, they die, their carcasses decompose and release all those nutrients into the lakes. And those nutrients then accumulate at the bottom of a lake. And you can go and take a little simple device like this, it's just a tube, you can drop it into the sediments, pull it up, and because the sediments are layered, so last year's sediments settle to the bottom of the lake, they're covered by this year's sediments, those will be covered by next year's sediments. So you have a chronology of the history of that lake in one of these tubes. And we can slice it up, and just a little bit of sample like that has about 1,000 years of history of this lake. Well, it turns out that the nitrogen that the salmon bring back from the ocean have a distinct, we call it an isotope characteristic, so it's like a flavor of nitrogen that we can measure analytically. And we know that salmon bring back an enriched flavor of nitrogen, so we can go back through the sediments and ask how enriched is the historical record in the sediments, and from that infer how many fish were there before we were around counting them. So this is what the data looks like. It's a very noisy slide, but there's a simple message that I want you to take away from it. So these are all of the major sockeye-producing lakes in western Alaska. It turns out to be something like 55% of the world's sockeye salmon production comes out of these lakes. The lakes in green boxes are lakes that have a waterfall, so fish can't swim up into them and spawn and release their nutrients. So they're what we call our reference systems. And what I'm plotting here is the last 500 years of history of these lakes, and then this isotope ratio or isotope flavor. And you can see for the lakes that don't have salmon, it's been very constant for 500 years. Every other lake on here has salmon in it now and probably had salmon in it historically. And you can see in each case, look at the values on the vertical axis here, they're much higher, but they're highly variable. So often it's the case we think of nature existing in this harmonious equilibrium before humans showed up and started messing it up. Well, in the case of this, if we look at the last 500 years, these systems have been highly variable, even prior to commercial fishing. And there weren't enough people here prior to commercial fishing to cause these changes due to subsistence fishing. So these are natural dynamics that are non-human induced dynamics in the system. The other thing I want you to evaluate here is that the patterns of ups and downs from one lake to the next are not the same. So even before fishing, individual rivers were marching to the beat of their own drums. Some had 200-year cycles, like this one here. This is the Alagnac system. And here's one that has a 30-year cycle in it. And then there are others that are incredibly constant. So the point is simply the diversity of returns that we see currently from the last 100 years of data of commercial fishing returns seem to have played out prehistorically back for at least 500 years. And if we do some fancy statistics on it, we can just ask, well, what common signal is shared amongst all those lakes? And the only one that shows up to be significant is this one here, which shows this big decline in the last 100 years or so. Okay? So this is the decline in the amount of marine nutrients in these lakes. And this, of course, isn't a reflection of the fish crashing. This is a reflection of the commercial fishing, intercepting those fish, putting them in cans. So the nitrogen went somewhere else. It didn't end up in the lake bottom. So aside from that signal here, there's no coherent response across this region. So this response diversity and the resilience that it produces must have played out prehistorically. So why might this be? Some of it has to do with the genetics of these fish. They have different genetic identities and genes that are adapted to local populations. And some of it's the habitat. When you think about salmon habitat, one of the things you realize is that they do inhabit some streams that are brown and warm, other streams that are cold, other streams that are draining glaciers. And each one of those responds differently to overriding changes in the environment and in the climate. So here are four examples of what we would call catastrophes if these were anywhere else. In each case, there was some massive mortality event of the adults that were trying to spawn in these populations, but this is just Mother Nature playing out. All of these sites occurred in the same river basin. This is within the Wood River system, but they all occurred in different years. So here's a stream we call Berm Creek because it gets this big berm. The stream comes out of a mountain range here, drains out to the lake, but in the fall you can get storms that build up this big gravel berm that blocks off the stream. And in a typical year, during snow melt, spring melt, the river floods, the stream floods, and blows out the berm, such that when the fish come back, they swim back into the stream and spawn. But in this year, there was a winter drought. It was a really low snowpack. The stream never flooded in the spring, and it didn't blow out the berm. So as a result, 5,000 fish came back to spawn, and they literally couldn't get into the stream. They all died here. They're all full of eggs. None of them spawned, as far as we can tell. Here's another system up the road. So this was a result of a winter drought. This is just down the river about 10 miles or so. We're looking at a bunch of dried out salmon reds or nests. And in this case, these fish spawn in September. And typically the water levels come up when we get rains in September, October. This was a fall drought. Water levels continued to drop and about half that system dried up and those nests were obviously not viable. Here's a stream that comes out of a lake. The fish have to swim out of the lake and across this delta. It's an incredibly shallow delta until they make it into this stream. The stream is only about 10 feet wide and a mile and a half long, but a couple years ago it had somewhere between 60 and 80,000 fish that spawned in it. These are big fish in this much water. They just packed in there, but they all had to get over this delta. And in a year when there's a summer drought, the water's really low, and these things are literally crawling up through about half an inch of water to get into the stream. Well, there are these big brown furry things running around, knocking those fish off, and over half of them can die just at the stream mouth in a year with a summer drought. So this is all within the same river basin. We have this mosaic of habitat, and different parts of the mosaic are productive or not productive in different years because they have different fundamental characteristics in terms of where does the water come from that keeps them an aquatic habitat. This one's prone to winter drought, this one's prone to fall droughts, this one's prone to summer droughts. They're all within the same river basin. So when we think about salmon habitat, we need to recognize that it's a mosaic, and this mosaic is sort of flickering through time, okay? And the good spots are gonna pop up every now and then, and the bad spots are gonna pop up every now and then. What makes the overall system resilient and reliable is because there's this diversity of responses that plays out across the landscape. I want to show you one more example of this. This is from the Nooshagak River. This is a big river system here, very pristine in many ways. What it's known for is its big run of Chinook salmon or king salmon. The runs can be as big as 250,000 fish. Typically, it's more like 150,000 fish. And these things are caught in the commercial fishery down here in Nooshagak Bay. And the question really is, well, where in this vast river basin do they spawn? And it turns out we can use a trick of biology to figure this out. So this is the ear stone of a fish. These are called otoliths. Fish use them for balance and hearing. And these things grow within the fish's head. As the fish grows up, this otolith, as it's called, puts layers of bone-like material on. And you can take this out of an adult fish and cross-section it and polish it up, and you can see what looks like the rings on a tree here. Well, these are rings that are laid down on a daily basis on this otolith over the course of the fish's life. What we can do, and this is work by a fellow named Sean Brennan, is we can take a laser and zap a little bit of material from near the core of this otolith and then analyze the isotopes, in this case of strontium, and then map those isotopes onto the river system, because this river system has a lot of variation due to the geology of different isotope signatures across it. So we can take an individual fish that's caught in the ocean, pull its otolith out, zap it with a laser, and then from the data that comes off of that laser, put that fish on the map somewhere in terms of where it was born. So then you can add up all the fish and make a heat map like this and ask, well, what part of the river basin produced fish? So you can see this is a pretty big river. It's a couple hundred kilometers long. There's 10,000 miles of stream in this thing. It's a big place. And in 2011, we analyzed 255 fish, and this is a heat map that produced all the fish from this system in that year. And you can see this tributary here in red. The hotter the color, the more fish that were produced. In that year, most of the fish were produced out of the King Salmon River, which is this thing right here. The Mulchatna, which is the biggest part of the river, actually didn't produce many fish. It's got a much cooler color. So if you were to go to this system and ask, well, let's prioritize where we're going to put our conservation efforts, the first place you'd probably go is this tributary right here. And if you were to put something second on the priority list, you'd probably list this tributary over here, if what you're trying to do is protect the fish. So we went back and did this from fish caught in 2014, and this is what the heat map looks like. So I'm just going to zip back and forth here. And you can see that it's fluctuating back and forth from year to year. And what it's really doing is reinforcing this idea that the habitat is this mosaic of conditions. Certain parts of the mosaic are good in some years. Other parts of the mosaic are good in other years. The fish have options, and what makes the system sustainable is because there's all this diversity out there in the landscape. You start nibbling away at that, and you're going to take options away from fish, and they're probably not going to be as reliable from year to year. Okay, going to talk now a little bit about the same idea, but drill it into finer and finer or smaller and smaller spatial scales. So some of you are probably sport fishers, and when you think about fish habitat, like this nice rainbow, you often think about, you know, the big pieces of water, the bigger rivers, the deeper water where you actually go and catch these big fish. You know, when we think about critical habitat for fish, you know, we do think about the bigger bodies of water, but we also think about all the small pieces of habitat, which are typically the areas where the juveniles grow up. And work by our group has started to look at, well, do these same ideas of a shifting habitat mosaic play out in the scales that are used by juvenile fish when they're in their first year of life or so? So if we look at an individual creek, this isn't Bear Creek, but I am going to talk about Bear Creek, and it looks a little bit like this. You have a river delta here with all sorts of old channels and new channels and tributaries coming in. Each one of these little tiny pieces of habitat has its own set of characteristic habitat features. And what's really important for fish in this part of the world is stream temperature. If it's too hot, they can't handle it. If it's too cold, they actually get chilled out to the point where they can't grow. So a guy named Johnny Armstrong did some work looking at juvenile coho salmon or silver salmon that spend 1 to 2 years in Bear Creek. And their primary prey are sockeye salmon, not the adults, of course. They're eating the eggs of sockeye salmon when the salmon come back to spawn. And what Johnny recognized, this is Bear Creek now, flowing out of a beaver meadow complex up here, flowing downstream. And it's relatively warm at the top. It's about 15 degrees Celsius, which is, what is that, about 60, high 50s. And it flows downstream, and at the bottom, you get some cold water springs that come in and cool that water off. It turns out that the sockeye salmon spawn down here in the nice cold water that has lots of oxygen in it. The coho salmon, Johnny found only up in the warm parts, but he knew that they were eating eggs from some of the chemical signatures in their diets. So what he suggested that they were doing was moving down to the cold sites to gobble up eggs, but then moving back upstream to warm up where they can actually metabolize, digest, and put a growth response on. Remember, salmon are cold-blooded animals, which means that their body temperatures equilibrate with the water temperatures that they're swimming in. And if the water temperature is too cold, their metabolism just shuts down. It's like when you have a leftover sandwich, you don't leave it on the dash of your truck, you put it in the refrigerator to slow down all the microbes and keep it around for a while. The same thing is going true with the metabolism of a fish. If it's cold, it's in the chiller, and nothing really happens. It has to be in warmer water to get the metabolic machinery going, assuming it's not too warm. So what Johnny did to test this hypothesis, so his idea was that they'd go down to gobble up eggs and then swim back up to the warm region to warm up and actually grow by digesting them. This distance here, from there to there, is on the order of about 1.5 miles. And we're talking about coho that are just a couple inches long. So what he did was put a couple of these little antennas here. These are what's called a pit tag reader. It's just an antenna that is listening for fish that swim over it but have a tag that we've implanted in them. And these tags are about the size of a grain of rice. They hold a unique numeric code. And if the fish swims over the antenna records the time of day, the day, and what the number on the tag was. So Johnny put the two antennas in right here, one there and one there, right between this transition between the cold area that's rich in food and the warm area that has a metabolic advantage for the fish, and then just listen for them. So here's one example of one of the fish. It was tagged up in section 3. It spent about 2 days there, and then after the sun went down, it blasted down about 1 mile, spent about 4 hours in the cold water, and went back up. Spent 3 days, did it again, spent about 3 hours, went back up. Each one of these migrations is about 1 mile in distance. For a fish that's this big, it's doing it at night probably because this is making it vulnerable to predators like otters and things. But what's going on here is the fish is actively exploiting the variation in the environment. They go to the cold water to feed on the high energy resource, but then they have to find warm water to digest that food. If you take the cold water away, you take away the food. If you take the warm water away, you take away the ability of the fish to make use of that food. So how does it play out over a couple years? This was the first year that Johnny did it, and what I'm showing here is 2 kilometers of stream from the top to the bottom, and the color here corresponds to the temperature in degrees Celsius. So here's the nice warm water at the top, and then it's cold at the bottom. So the fish migrated between the warm part and the cold part in this year, the warm part and the cold part in this year, and then we got a really rainy summer. If you guys remember 2009, it rained all summer long. This stream was basically at flood stage all summer, and there was no temperature variation. So Johnny was distraught because he thought he had really discovered something interesting, so he waited around another year and did it again. We had another rainy year, no temperature variation. He was patient or slow or one of those things, waited a fifth year, we had another nice dry year, and again the temperature gradient showed up and the fish were migrating back and forth. So based on the story I just told you, what you might expect is that in the 2 flood years when everything was cold, those fish didn't grow very well. Well, it turns out they grew equally well in each five of these years. So something weird was going on. Either I was telling you a bunch of lies or they did something that we had yet to understand. And that was the case. So what I'm doing now is taking the three dry years where you have warm water at the top and cold water at the bottom, and I'm superimposing bubbles on each of these sections that shows where the fish are. And big bubbles mean there was a lot of fish in that part of the stream. The color of the bubble maps onto the temperature. So in the 3 years that were normal conditions, the fish were found during the day in nice warm water at the top of the system, except one weird day there. So they were actively exploiting the temperature variation. So the question is, what did they do in the cold year? So here I'm superimposing what they did in the cold year. In each case now, each little spike off of the main trunk here is habitat that was created because the river flooded up, spilled over its banks, and flooded little puddles off to the side. Well, those puddles then warmed up because they're nice, shallow, stagnant water, and this is where all the fish were now. All the fish stayed down in the bottom, but instead of having to migrate to the top of the system to find warm water, they just migrated off into the off-channel habitat and warmed up there. So the point here is you have this little tiny stream. Bear Creek is maybe 3 meters, so 10 feet across. It's a couple miles long, and the fish can always find cold water to binge on eggs, and they can always find warm water to digest those eggs. But where the habitat is depends on what the flow conditions are. In this case, the complexity in the system maintained options for these fish to find the growth conditions they needed to grow efficiently and survive when they hit the ocean. So that hopefully is an example of what really small-scale habitat diversity means for juvenile fish. Okay, I want to finish by talking a little bit about wildlife that depend on salmon. So, of course, here's some more sockeye that are coming back to spawn. It turns out that in addition to feeding lots of people, these animals also feed lots of other animals, such as bears and rainbow trout, birds, insects, you name it. And things like bears and trout in the Bristol Bay region, you know, they're putting on somewhere between 80 and 90% of their annual growth by feeding on salmon. So most of the year, they're not really doing too much. They're getting by on eating vegetation, usually if they're bears. And in the case of fish, they're not growing much at all except eating the occasional insect. The question is, how can they achieve such remarkable growth rates feeding on salmon? Because the challenge is that salmon are there for just a very short period of time. So here's a couple fun pictures. This is a sow, brown bear. She's scratching on a tree. Some of you have probably seen these. These are these signpost trees that bears will scratch on. You can see, you can't quite see it. She's peeing down here, so she's marking here, scratching on this thing. But look at how bony this animal is. This is in, I think that should say June 28th. This is before the salmon showed up. You can see her leg bones are sticking out. She is not in very good condition. But by the end of the season, a sow bear will look like that. You know, so that bear is probably 300 pounds. This one's probably close to 600 pounds. And as hopefully this will work, you'll see she's very happy. Feels like there should be music playing or something. Anyhow, these bears can only make a living because they have access to salmon. If there wasn't salmon here, they would be much smaller, they'd be much lower densities. And the question is, how do they exploit the salmon so effectively? So, actually, I think this is a bit out of order. So I'm going to show you one other thing here. One of the other things we recognize, and lots of people recognize, is that in places where there's lots of fish, the bears kill a lot of those fish, but they eat very few of them. In fact, most salmon that are killed by bears, at best, the bear will eat just a little nibble out of them. So let's see if this will play now. So here's a grizzly, just killed a salmon, took one little bite out of its head, and walked on. You know, what's wrong with this predator? This is supposed to be a big, nasty predator that eats these salmon in one big gulp. Play it one more time because it's fun. So one little bite. What they eat here is mostly the brain. The brain is a very fatty tissue. And what's going on here is the bear is high grading. Okay? So that bear could binge and feed on like 10 salmon and be full, and it would take all day to digest those, but they choose not to do that. What they do is they go around, they take a little tiny nibble out of each fish on average, and move on. And the question is, why are they doing that? Well, the reason they're doing that is because they can satiate themselves. They can eat as much as they can, but they could either fill up on low-quality food, which is the whole salmon body, or they can feed on the highest quality tissues, which are the brains. So then the question is, and it turns out they can only access the salmon when the salmon are in shallow water and spawning. Well, in a typical population, you know, a sockeye salmon will only spawn for about 3 weeks, roughly speaking. So what that means is those bears would have about 3 weeks to walk around and eat the brains out of salmon. So the question is, how do they achieve 50% of their body mass growth in one summer if they only have access to fish for 3 weeks? Well, it turns out they have access to fish for much longer because there is variation across the watershed. And here's an example of that. Each dot here and the blue line shows you when fish are spawning in a bunch of different streams, rivers, and lakes. And what you can see is there's variation. Fish start spawning in the Wood River watershed around the middle of July, and then other populations are still going in late September, early October. So there's this, we call it a wave of salmon that sort of propagates across the landscape. And if the predators contract this wave of salmon, they can actually feed on salmon for almost 3 months. So the question is, do the predators track this wave of salmon? I won't show you the data, but by tagging rainbows, we can see that they move around. They start at cold sites, which are the places where salmon spawn early, and they work their way across the landscape. And by late September, the places to catch rainbows is in the big rivers, which tend to be warm and have late spawning populations of sockeye. So how about the bears? Do this really simply. We just put up game cameras on streams. The color of the line here tells you what the water temperature is. So here's a fairly cold stream. It's about 6 degrees Celsius. And we put a camera up here in June. You see no bears on it until about the middle of July, which is basically the day the salmon enter the stream. The bears are there. This is the cumulative number of photos taken. So we get hundreds of photos of bears for about the next 3 weeks. Then the salmon are done, and the bears disappear. We don't see any more bears for the rest of the season. So what happens if we overlay some other streams here? So here I've overlaid another 5 streams. Again, the color tells you what the temperature is. And basically, all the bears are packed onto cold streams early in the season. And then those streams finish up their spawning. All the fish are dead at this point and being decomposed by bacteria and eaten by insects and whatnot. And by September, the only bears you see out there in the landscape are in warm sites. So what this means is that the topographic variation, you know, some streams are draining mountains, others are draining flat wetland areas, have different temperature regimes. Different temperature regimes produce different evolutionary pressures on salmon, produces different spawn timing of salmon, and then the predators track this across the landscape and can binge on salmon for up to 3 months rather than just a couple weeks. For those who like birds, here are glaucous winged gulls. We have a few more data points here, but again, all the gulls which are scavenging salmon are on cold streams early in the season. They're still binging on salmon in September, but they've moved across the landscape to somewhere else that has late spawning populations. So you can think about this like having 7 all-you-can-eat buffets here in downtown Palmer. If all the restaurants have the all-you-can-eat buffet on the same day, you know, they're not going to produce a lot of food that people in Palmer are going to eat. But if every restaurant has an all-you-can-eat buffet on a different day, you're going to have a lot of well-fed people living in Palmer because you can binge every day of the week rather than forced to do it all in one day. And that's exactly what's going on with a complex watershed, different hydrology, different spawn timing of salmon, an extended growing period for the predators. So in this case, really the message here is that watershed complexity provides these options for animals that can move across the landscape. And by taking away some of these individual streams, particularly those cold streams, which tend to be small, you take away this early feeding option away from the predators, whether the predators is predators are bears, birds, or rainbow trout. So thinking about climate change, you know, one of the messages that we should, or one of the things we need to be thinking about in terms of conservation is what do we do to maintain the functioning of our landscapes, of our watersheds, given that climate change is happening and it's going to continue to happen for at least another century. It doesn't matter what we do to emissions. We're going to be living in a warmer world for the next century, independent of whether we decide to cut back on greenhouse gases. The question is, can we predict what they're going to look like? You know, this is where science has a role to play in increasing the precision of our forecast for what the future is going to look like. But I think the important message is we can do a lot of tangible things now to protect our ecosystems and make them less risk-prone to climate change without having a lot more scientific information. Okay, so there are things we can do now to make our ecosystems resilient to climate change. And really the message here is that keep diversity in the landscapes is one tangible thing we can do to reduce the risks of ongoing climate change. We don't need better climate models to do this. We have some good ideas about what fish habitat looks like, what hydrology does across river basins, and we can start locking up and protecting some of that diversity, which we know is important now for the functioning of the ecosystem. And part of this has to do with maintaining disturbances. So floodplain rivers and rivers that I've been talking about today have all this complexity in them because they're continuously disturbed. Things like floods rip through them, and you know, here's a little stream that used to flow out over here. Big storm came through, and it blew out and took a new path. You know, if this was Washington, the Department of Transportation would be out there with their bulldozers trying to put their stream back in its channel. But this is what streams do. They wander around across the floodplain in response to disturbances such as floods, and it's this type of erosion pattern that produces this mosaic of habitat that salmon need to thrive under. And just to quote Aldo Leopold, who I'm sure many of you know is one of the godfathers of conservation in the U.S., you know, he said that keeping every cog and wheel as a first precaution of intelligent tinkering, you know, describing how we need to maintain habitats and keep biodiversity around. He was probably thinking about this because he did think about so many things, but I guess what I think we should add to this is we need to think about what the processes are that produce the diversity in the first place. And in the case of salmon ecosystems, they're typically highly disturbed sites. They've been disturbed by glaciers, and they're continuously disturbed by flooding events and erosional patterns. And that's what produces the spice of life that makes these salmon ecosystems resilient. So if we go to the lower 48, this is the Skagit River. It's a big river just north of Seattle. This is our best estimate of what the wetland complex looked like in the 1860s. Lots of color here, lots of different small tributaries, large rivers, etc. And then mostly Dutch guys showed up and turned this into a big tulip farm. And what they did here is they drained and diked this whole thing. And what they did was simplify the system and take all these options off the table that would be used by fish, and presumably were used by fish in the 1860s. Now there are tens of millions of dollars being poured into the Skagit River to try to get some of it back. And, you know, despite a lot of effort and a lot of money and a lot of good people working on this, it is really expensive and incredibly ineffective. They will never be able to get the system back to where it was unless they buy up all that farmland and take all those dikes out, etc. So the message here is, you know, thinking forward from this stage, we can actually do a lot to protect the diversity in this system and therefore the resilience in the system. And these sort of things are coming to Alaska. I mean, you can see it here in your backyard. Here's a beautiful image that Chris Stark from UAF lent to me. The Chena River up near Fairbanks, here's the main channel wiggling through the floodplain here. But all of these things are old relic channels that were left behind as the river migrated across the floodplain. Well, these are partially connected and seasonally connected, and you can guarantee that these backwaters were used as critical habitat by juvenile salmon and other juvenile fishes. Well, now we have a highway rolling through here, and I'm sure there's some good culverts and whatnot along this. But what we've done is basically constrain the river here so that it has limited capacity to wander across there and keep generating that habitat, which you can guarantee is critical for maintaining the productivity for the fisheries. And there's some really good examples of land trusts in Alaska that are doing their best to try to conserve land. You know, the Tim Troll and gang with the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust are making a lot of important successes in places like the Nooshigak to try to protect places of habitat that are important to fish. And again, part of the message here is it's easy to get sucked into thinking about we need to keep the main stem rivers, the big chunks of habitat. But what we now realize from studying these systems for decades is that all those little small pieces also matter a lot too. So what you need to think about when we think about protection for fish is you need to think about that network of habitat that fish use, both over the course of a single life cycle, but over the course of a single life cycle as it plays out over decades or even centuries, if you want to think that far into the future. So really the message here is that stability and productivity of fisheries systems ultimately derives from diverse and changing habitat. You know, nature doesn't exist in a single static condition. It's a complex system, and the system is this moving target. And that's the type of system that salmon have evolved to, and that's the type of system we should aim to maintain if we want to keep productive fisheries in the game into the future. So thanks. I'm happy to answer any questions.
If you have questions, please use the microphone so that we can conserve your questions for the radio. Questions? I didn't mean to scare you.
Yeah, on one of the early slides you had on there, it showed you were showing how the composition of the total Bristol Bay run was changing over time. And reaching way back to the early 1900s, were they monitoring all those streams, even though they weren't producing streams? How did they get the stock compositions back then?
So what I showed you was starting in, I think, 58 or 62 was the first year. So UW people did some stream surveys in the 1940s, and that's what we've continued through to now. Prior to that, no one was doing anything on the spawning grounds.
Okay, thanks.
In, well, the canneries were actually, you know, they had these, what were they called, cannery, anyhow, super, not superintendents, but they'd be out there looking at quality of the product, et cetera. But some of those folks were actually interested in the biology, so they'd be out hiking around trying to estimate where the fish were going and these sort of things. But getting around that part of Alaska in the early, you know, 1900s was pretty tough going, so they didn't see a lot of the landscape. After World War II, there were planes everywhere. That's when biologists really could get around the landscape really easily, and that's when some of these ideas were starting to be appreciated. And, of course, there's traditional knowledge, too, that talks about where the fish were historically. But, again, the traditional knowledge was mostly focused on the bigger tributaries, not necessarily the finer scale things that we actually go out of our way to study because we're paid to study and we don't have to go there to catch fish to make a living on.
I guess another question, if no one else has one, but when you mentioned, I think it was the White Act, was that when the game plan was to let half the fish escape and then catch the other half?
Yeah.
I remember I worked at Carlick for a while, and I think the way that they did it back then was they tried to harvest the first half and let the second half escape, and you get a real change in the stock compositions. Was it like that in Bristol Bay as well?
You know, the Bristol Bay management system is remarkable in a bunch of ways because a lot of these ideas about diversity have been appreciated by those managers for decades. So what they have is they have an escapement goal for the season, but then they also have a schedule of escapement basically by day over the course of the season. And, you know, the managers are all motivated to try to distribute as much of the harvest over the entire run as much as they can. In practice, yeah, they load up a little more harvest on the back end than on the front end. But in general, I think they do a very good job at trying to allow as much representation across the entire run to escape into the watersheds.
And so that was the strategy even back when the White Act was in place?
Not during the White Act. The White Act was just take, you know, they have an escapement goal, sort of. I'm not sure they really had anyone to enforce it, and they just hammered them after that number had passed up the river. It's more though, since Fish and Game took over, that they've been trying to distribute the harvest over the course of the run. And, you know, new genetic techniques and better monitoring and these sort of things have made them more, even more effective than they were, say, 40, 50 years ago. But again, it's, you know, in terms of Fish and Game, they've sort of appreciated a lot of these ideas. Trying to fill up the spawning grounds is the way they talk about it.
Okay, excellent presentation. Thank you.
I can't only get questions from the scientists in the audience.
So, Daniel, your presentation suggests that there's some caution that should be taken if we define critical habitat based on a study done 1 year, that maybe the critical habitat the next year might actually be a little bit different, and that the lateral habitat is really important, especially in high flood years.
Yeah.
So when we think about conservation priorities, what's your recommendation for how, at a regional scale, we think about protecting important habitat for fish?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the simple message is that if you go out and you sample where the fish are in any given year, or even a small number of years, you're going to estimate a much smaller proportion of the landscape that they actually use over longer periods of time. And over the course of decades, fish will use some pieces of habitat that you would simply write off as unacceptable or unviable habitat in some years that become important, say, during those flood years, or become important because they're a cold water refuge during really warm years. So the message is really think about how to maintain habitat options for fish over long time periods, and really what that means is protecting the floodplains, protecting the riparian areas along floodplains, and allow rivers to wander around in those habitats to generate this fine-scale habitat, off-channel habitat. Some is cold, some is warm, some is productive, some is unproductive. It's that mosaic that matters, and what you need to protect are those areas around the active channel. Again, we tend to focus on, here's the water flowing through the river right now, that's the important stuff. But the reality is, if the river is working the way it should, a few decades later, the river may actually be over here, and that remnant channel is what is used by baby fish to stay warm or get away from predators or whatever. So ultimately, it's about protecting the floodplain, allowing the rivers to wander around, and create the habitat that fish use.
Sort of related to that question, doesn't it scare you a little bit that the scale of climate change, when you looked at your very first map of the red spots in the world, might be a little bit too large to factor in when you look at a river channel compared to the scale of climate change? I mean, that's what really strikes me with your presentation is biodiversity is really important, but we have this enormous, you know, elephant in the room of temperature change that's going to affect everything.
That's true. You know, you look at the scale of global climate change, and it is scary. I mean, the models that were the most extreme 10 years ago and were written off as you know, liberal-minded academics who are out of touch with reality, we now realize that those model projections for the trajectory of climate change were actually conservative. We're beating them. So part of my message here today is, we're going to have to do some things to deal with climate change. Reducing emissions is certainly part of the action, but maintaining habitat is something we can do now in real places, because it's the real places, it's places like this river valley that is going to affect people. It's not the global average that's going to affect people, it's how the climate plays out in certain places. In the case of fish, fish are not encountering the climate directly. The fish are encountering the climate as it's filtered through the local habitat conditions, you know, the hydrology, the topography of the ground that it's flowing over, interactions with groundwater. So you think about what we can do to deal with climate change, we can protect habitat at local scales, because that's tangible and it's going to have real effects, and guarantee it. Where the tipping point is, it's out there in the future somewhere, I'm not sure we can really predict that. But, you know, if we want to be at least a bit optimistic, protecting habitat is something we can do that will have tangible benefits.
So Bristol Bay is an amazing exception. And what we deal with in Cook Inlet and other areas throughout Alaska are trying as hard as we can to protect the habitat inland and recognizing what's going on there, be it mega projects or roads or whatever, and water temperature. But that seems to only be half of the problem. The other half seems to be out there in the ocean somewhere. And any insight into that? Like, it seems like as hard as we try inland, we still have this other uncontrollable beast out there that isn't always acknowledged.
Yeah. So, yeah, the ocean is a big gorilla that has its own behavior, and there's not much we can do about that. You know, we can have effective fishery management that's mostly playing out in the marine part of their life cycle. But the other way to think about it is the ocean is going to send different numbers of fish back to watersheds. And during certain years, the ocean's going to be a very productive place, and it's going to send lots of fish back. You know, here we can use experience from places like Oregon, where during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, the ocean off of Oregon was an incredibly productive place for coho salmon in particular. And what they were doing is logging the heck out of their watersheds, and the more they logged, the more fish came back. And what they were doing was replacing freshwater habitat with hatcheries, okay? And because the ocean was such a productive place, the prevailing attitude at the time was, well, let's just keep pumping fish out of hatcheries. The ocean's going to send them back as nice, big, juicy fish that we can catch. Well, then the climate changed, and the ocean off of Oregon headed south, literally, and was no longer a productive place to produce salmon. And at this point, all the freshwater habitat had been trashed, and they lost all their fisheries because the hatcheries could not produce the fish that were supporting these populations historically. It's up to people like you who come out to talks like this to think about what do we want with our development projects. They are going to have effects. There's no question about that. So the question is, how much do we value some new mega project versus the habitat that produces things like fish that do also have tangible economic and social values? In some cases, they may be totally compatible. In other cases, we can't even pretend they're going to be compatible because they're not.
I have a question about the genetic diversity over small stream segments that you mentioned. Our local stream, the closest one here, just 3 miles away, has got probably the largest escapement for the entire Matanuska. It's just a short little side tributary. It has a unique stressor, the outfall for the city of Palmer's sewer system. And interestingly, they seem to be linked. The question is, how long did it take for, is there genetic diversity likely that enables them to adjust to those particular unique habitats, which includes obviously a very high nutrient and food source?
Yeah. Yeah, so really the question, I think, is how quickly can salmon evolve new genetically based strategies to changes in the environment? And, you know, the best example of this is from some of Tom Quinn's work, who's another professor at Washington, who went to New Zealand to study Pacific salmon. And New Zealand, of course, didn't have Pacific salmon down there, but in, I think, around 1910, they transplanted a single population of salmon from the Sacramento River, and they moved it into, I think it was 7 or 8 major rivers in New Zealand. And these things established, they started migrating between the ocean and the freshwater. Who the heck knows how they figured it out, but they did. Well, Quinn went back in about 2000, so 90 years later, about 15 generations, and then went in and studied the genetics of each of the populations in New Zealand. Remember, these all came from a common stock. And within something like 90 years, each of those rivers now had its own locally adapted strain of Chinook salmon. They had their own timing of when they went to the ocean. They had their own timing of when they returned. The sizes of their eggs was different, and it reflected the local gravel conditions of each of those individual rivers. So the simple answer is it happens pretty quickly in ecological time. It can happen over the course of 5-10 generations. And that's another answer here, is if we want to talk about resilience in the system, we have to let the system and the habitat evolve, but also give the animals a chance to evolve in response to the habitat. And in lots of cases, and we've learned this in the Pacific Northwest, is by flooding the system full of hatchery fish, we take away those evolutionary options for fish. So hatcheries we have to use really carefully if we don't want to screw it all up in terms of the evolutionary potential of salmon.
I was just wondering if you experienced any straying of salmon for more favorable habitats, if you knew what stream or watershed they were going to come up to through the isotopes, strontium or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good question. The question's about strain, and this is one of the paradoxes of salmon biology, because we all know that salmon come back to spawn in the place they were born. But at the same time, we know that if, for instance, if a glacier recedes as it is in Glacier Bay and a new stream is formed, there's fish that find that place within a couple years and start establishing there. So this is one of the remarkable things that salmon do, is they have high abilities to go home to their home stream, but they also are really good pioneers. They can find new habitat when it becomes available. And as a scientist, I don't think we really know what allows them to both be good prospectors but also show high fidelity to their home stream. The simple answer is we know that fish do stray into new habitat all the time. And some of that's adaptive. I mean, you think about being successful in a highly disturbed landscape like under after glaciers have receded, and the adaptation is to be weedy and colonize all the new habitat. Salmon do that really well. But they also have this ability to go home to their natal stream. That's a paradox that scientists don't have a really good handle on how it works out. We do know from genetic studies in places like Bristol Bay that do have lots of salmon in them, is that if a salmon comes back to a stream where it wasn't born, it's very unlikely to be successful at finding a mate there. Whereas if that same fish goes back and spawns in the stream where it was born, it's much more likely to be successful in its home stream. So it has something to do with this habitat being open that makes it successful. But it's a big mystery still. It's a great question.
I guess you showed that one slide earlier where you added it was had to do with the ice breakup, and you added 2016 on there, showing the very early. I assume there were really warm water temperatures going on there too. Were you seeing an increased incidence of just salmon that were dying from heat, just from thermal stress?
So that's what's interesting here. Last year was unbelievably warm. The water temperatures were warm. The fish looked amazing. You know, the fish looked amazing. They figured it out. They found cold water refugia either deep in the lakes or they'd pool up off of cool streams coming in off of steep watersheds. And we saw very little pre-spawning mortality.
And were water levels okay, that they weren't getting stranded from streams petering out or something?
No, I mean, the water levels were definitely low. There was low snowpack, and streams that depend on snowmelt were relatively low. But again, these fish can, you've seen this, they can wiggle through really tiny amounts of water, and one of their biggest, at least in the small streams, avoiding the predators is one of their biggest challenges. But then they sneak in at night. We have fish that move into these little tiny streams. They sneak in at night, they spawn, and they get out of there before they get nailed by a bear. They have these, you know, this remarkable portfolio of behavioral strategies for dealing with all sorts of warm and cold conditions.
I've seen them on the good news drainage where the stream, the outlets of the streams dried up and the fish couldn't get up into the lake itself.
Yeah.
And they ended up just stalling out and dying right in place.
So that certainly occurs some places at some times, but then, I don't need to tell this to you because you know it, but you know, for each one of these female sockeye that drops her eggs in the gravel, you know, those eggs will spend most of a year incubating in the gravel. Then they'll spend 1 or 2 years in the lakes before they go to the ocean. And then they'll come back after either 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years in the ocean. So then you think about why would evolution do that? Shouldn't evolution produce the optimal behavioral strategy? Well, the optimal behavioral strategy is for that female to have eggs that do a whole bunch of different things, because if there's a bad year like the one you're describing now, well, the fish that return next year from that same mom will make it are more likely to make it successfully next year. So, you know, they're hedging their bets against uncertain climate conditions. And yeah, with climate change, we may see lower water levels and more stranding that's going on. But right now, it doesn't, you know, it hasn't played out to the point where, you know, we've been concerned about it.
I wondered if you had any comments on your component analysis where you looked at the depletion of marine nitrogen, I think if I understood it, over the last 100 years, if that has any consequences for ecosystem in the lakes.
Yeah, so that's been on a lot of people's minds about the idea that commercial fisheries are intercepting all these marine nutrients that are coming back to watersheds. And we've put a lot of effort into trying to understand this one. And here's my simple answer for you. There's certainly less marine-derived nutrients coming back to these lakes now and these watersheds now than there was before commercial fishing. It's probably on the order of a half to a third as much as coming back now. We can also show you from the sediments that there's less algae in those lakes than there was in the 1800s, okay? But if you look at how many fish are produced from these lakes, and this is the escapement plus the catch, there's just as many fish, or even, we think, a few more fish produced now than there were before commercial fisheries developed. So the ecosystem, if you're interested in the growth of algae, is probably less productive now than it was historically. But the systems are producing just as many fish. What this tells us is that what's limiting in these watersheds is probably not the nutrients, but the amount of spawning habitat. I think places or the components of the ecosystem that are most likely to be affected are the direct consumers of salmon, things like bears, things like trout, things like birds. But again, looking at our systems here, they're not constrained by the number of fish that return. They're actually constrained by the duration of time they have access to salmon, which is really a reflection of the life history diversity in the watershed. And as best as we can tell, there's been no erosion of the life history diversity in these watersheds, and that they still have this long access to salmon. So you also hear crazy stories, particularly in British Columbia and lower 48, that salmon runs made trees grow big and these sort of things. And that's bordering on ridiculous. You just add up the nutrients brought back by salmon. It doesn't add up to enough to make a difference to trees. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but, you know, I believe that salmon are important in these watersheds, but I think what they're most important for are the animals that eat them directly. The fertilization effects, the evidence for that is very, very weak. It's a great story. It's a story of biblical proportions, but it doesn't hold up to the data.
What about over-escapement?
Over-escapement. Are you a fisherman?
Sport.
Sport fisherman, okay. So over-escapement is this idea, for those who don't know, maybe everyone knows this. The idea is that if the... it's mostly propagated by or promoted by commercial fishermen, but the idea is if too many fish are in the watersheds, that competition amongst those fish is so intense that very few of them return. So the idea is you have to harvest them relatively heavily to make sure that not too many fish end up in the watersheds. Well, again, if we ask the data to question whether there's support for that over-escapement issue, and it's essentially non-existent. For Chinook salmon, there's some evidence for it in some rivers. For sockeye salmon, for pink salmon, the evidence is very, very shaky. The whole idea of over-escapement is a bogus idea, in my view. From an ecological standpoint. From an economic standpoint, clearly over-escapement is a reality because those are fish that could have been harvested that aren't necessarily contributing to the population.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation. It's great. One slide you showed the returns to the Quijack. I think in the 50s and 60s were really high, and the other rivers were not contributing. Any speculation what was going on there?
Yeah. We could, well, scientists can always speculate, right? So how long you got?
We got time.
Yeah, you know, so the simple answer is we don't have a good understanding for why these things shuffle around. From the Kwijak, we do know that a lot of the fish that produced those monstrous runs were fish that spawned on some of the islands, which is a very unique, we call it an ecotype of salmon. And what I think is going on is that for random chance or whatever flukes of nature there was a couple generations of salmon that did really well on those beaches in Iliamna Lake. And then they sort of resonated for a few decades and went away. Why the other rivers came back up, that was coincident with that. A lot of it happened in the mid-70s when there was a big shift in the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And rivers like the Wood River became substantially warmer. And when those lakes warm up a little bit, they produce better growing conditions for the juvenile sockeye. They grow a little bigger. They probably survive a little more when they go to the ocean. And their productivity came up. The Kwijak, you know, Iliamna is such a big lake, it really didn't warm up very much after the 70s, so I'm not sure that there was much of an effect on the growing conditions. But I'm just telling stories. We don't really have a good explanation for what caused this shift. We just know it happened. And the fact that it happened tells us something about what are some of the important attributes of these ecosystems, and that's this complexity. Was there another question here?
I was just wondering if you saw any correlation to, like, I guess you could call it overescapement or overpopulation of a river and lower oxygen availability and productivity of eggs?
Yeah, that's a really good idea, too, that if you get, you know, this is a mechanism that could produce an overescapement effect. And that is true that when you get a high number of fish in the streams, they do consume more of the oxygen, and therefore they could die. So there are some rivers, the Branch River, or do you fish in Bristol Bay?
No.
Okay. So the Alagnac River a few years ago had some monstrous escapements. They had escapements of 5 or 6 million fish into these relatively small rivers, and they had massive pre-spawning mortality events. And those occurred during some really hot conditions when the water temperatures were warm, and probably there were so many fish in there that they were also stressed by oxygen. In most of the systems we work in, we don't see oxygen stress. You know, they're shallow enough that the oxygen is exchanging with the atmosphere, and the fish seem pretty tolerant. In the case of coho salmon, coho have pretty unique, or silver salmon, they have pretty unique physiology, so they can actually tolerate really low oxygen conditions. And that's one of the reasons they're really successful in beaver ponds and wetlands and these sort of things, is they can handle those low oxygen conditions. So yeah, that process probably does play out in certain places and times, but I don't think it's very common.
Thank you very much.
I'm just supposed to wrap this up, and I don't have much to say, but just to bring it back to the Matsu, I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, is it important to protect Cottonwood Creek or the Wasilla Creek that's in the middle of, you know, our cities and are subject to urban development. And as Daniel was talking, Dr. Shinlin was talking, I was thinking, you know, yes, I mean, that's one argument for protecting these streams, because you could say, well, what's Cottonwood Creek? It's not important. We've got the whole Deschke River. We've got Kashwitna. We've got all these streams that are totally unimpacted. So why worry about this impacted stream, you know, in the middle of our town? But those streams, like Cottonwood Creek, may be super important for a time like 2012, where we have a flood event, the Little Sioux's washing out. But Cottonwood Creek, that has this lake system that ameliorates the flows, that may provide kind of a refuge during those disturbance events and other systems that provide the resiliency to the overall system. So a good argument for protecting our urban streams, our impacted streams, and even your own property along those streams. I'd also like to encourage you, any of you that aren't members of the Matsu Salmon Partnership, to look us up online, and there's this handout on the table back there. It shows a little bit about what the partnership's doing. And then also feel free, of course, to come and listen to the talks tomorrow. Thanks again for coming tonight. Thanks again, Dr. Shinlin.